President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. When we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this October the 1st on the West Coast, now October the 2nd on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome all those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, and hopefully you're listening to Station 2. If you are listening to this show, then you are on Station 2. And I'm sure anyone who wasn't paying attention or was not aware of the fact that we moved tonight, this is our maiden voyage, so to speak, on this station, still bbsradio.com, just another corner for us to shout out from. I'm going to go right into bringing tonight's guest on. He is our regular Friday night guest. Since the inception of the show, he's been a weekly guest and my co-host. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher. And I like to call him our resident science advisor. He is none other than our good friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Don. How are you this evening?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Jim, in the past, I'm going to say nine months, we have been doing a number of shows on things like consciousness and awareness, responsibility. We have been talking about how people can tap into their higher powers, the true nature of a human being, the reality of the spiritual world and universal concepts and the role that science plays in that, education, religion. We've gone through the whole gamut. And for the past 2 weeks, we've been talking about who's pulling the strings behind the scenes, despite what we're told officially by the media, which is nothing more than a propaganda mouthpiece for government, which is nothing more than organized crime masquerading as the leaders of the world. and it's quite a chaotic situation that's been created. And I know that you want to talk about this whole subject of disclosure and the reality that we face. You have any opening thoughts you want to share? I have a clip that I'd like to play in the regard of some recent disclosure, but I want to first entertain your thoughts.
Well, there's so many things going on. I thought it might be interesting to, you know, touch on some topics which the listening audience can check upon on their own. You know, it's all very well and good to just listen to us hypothecate about different things, but I think most people eventually like the idea of being able to actually verify some of the things that we present them with on the show. Mm-hmm. And so earlier today, I started looking around for material of that sort. And as you know, we had a previous discussion which led to you're locating this clip. So I think that maybe the thing to do would be to just play that, and then we can comment as in depth as we want afterwards.
Okay. All right. This is from a National Press Club meeting earlier this year as part of the Disclosure Project. And this is Captain Robert Salas, formerly with the U.S. Air Force. And he's going to start any moment here now.
My name is Robert Solis. Contrary to what it says on the card, I was not a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. I was in the Air Force active duty after I graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1964 until 1971 and separated as a captain. In March of 1967, I was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, as a missile launch officer, Minuteman missiles. On an early morning of March 16th, 1960, primary security guard upstairs. We had about six, as I recall, flight security airmen upstairs. I was downstairs 60 feet underground in a capsule, monitoring and controlling 10 nuclear-tipped Minuteman missiles. I got a call that morning that they were seeing strange lights flying in the sky. I disregarded that call, told them to call me when something more significant happened. I got another call subsequent to that call, and this time it was a more intense tone in the guard's voice. It was very clearly very frightened. He said there was a bright, glowing red object hovering outside the front gate. It was oval-shaped. He had all the other guards out there with their weapons drawn. Right after that call, I woke up my commander, who was on a rest period, Fred Maiwald, a retired colonel now, and told him about the phone calls. As I was telling him about the phone calls, my weapons started going down, one after the other. They went into a no-go condition, what we call no-go condition. They were unlaunchable. We lost somewhere between six and eight weapons that morning within minutes of having received that second phone call of a UFO hovering outside the front gate. Again that morning, after reporting it to the command post, we were informed that a very similar incident happened at Echo Flight. I was at Oscar Flight. They lost all 10 of their weapons under similar circumstances, very similar circumstances, where UFOs were sighted over the launch facilities. They had maintenance crews and security crews out there that had spent the night, and they were reporting UFOs over those sites. And the commander of that flight was Eric Carlson. He also separated as a captain, and the deputy commander was Walt Fiegel, who retired as a lieutenant colonel. We have those witnesses that I just mentioned. The names I just mentioned have spoken of this event before, and they will back up this story. We also have documentation that I received through FOIA requests from the Air Force outlining the Echo Flight incident and including in that documentation a reference to UFOs. We have telexes covering this incident, and in one telex it says the fact that no apparent reason for the loss of 10 missiles can be readily identified is cause for grave concern to this headquarters. This was from SAC headquarters. So we've got those telexes. I've got about 12 witnesses that'll verify parts of this story, including of a man who investigated the incident afterwards for the Air Force, and you'll hear a little bit more about that from the next witness. And also another guard that witnessed a UFO in that same time period, and another officer, who retired a full colonel, who had other reports of UFOs. Ancillary to that, I've got the complete report on a Minot, North Dakota incident. That was Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, which happened in August of 1966. Very similar. UFOs sighted over missile silos, and also a UFO incident that was investigated by the Air Force immediately after our incident within a week. I'm willing to testify to the truth of all these matters that I've spoken about in front of Congress under oath. Thank you.
Now, that interview, Jim, went on, that press conference went on for, I think, about an hour and 11 minutes with various speakers, and they were equally convincing. This was not something that Captain Salas was reading. He was obviously recalling his experience. And this came out very recently, so this in no way has influenced anything that you or I have been talking about on this show for a number of years. We have been speaking purely from our personal experience, telling people they don't have to believe us. They can do the research themselves, and eventually you come up with material like what we're presenting tonight on the show. Your comments about what Captain Salas said.
Well, actually, there's a whole host of things that are worth commenting about or commenting on regarding not only his remarks, but that topic in general. First of all, it certainly is no coincidence that the presence of a UFO at this particular facility has been associated with weapons going to an unusable state. I mean, it's obvious that that was a deliberate show of capability, shall we call it, and that the technology possessed by these individuals is far superior to what we know how to do. And these primitive little rockets with the nuclear tips on them can easily be managed and made unusable by the individuals who are capable of designing and flying these anti-gravity craft. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we have been talking about stuff like this. I don't even know for how long. And I personally have read and talked with many, many people regarding various things that have occurred over the years of a similar vein, and which have been investigated by various people that I know. And the interesting thing here, of course, Don, is that now this stuff is starting to come out by very credible individuals who can back up their statements. And the thing that's exciting, in my opinion, is that the same agency which has been denying the existence of UFOs all these years in an official capacity has been caught with their pants down in an outright lie, because now you have people who have retired from the Air Force, and once they're clear of their initial oath, they are now presenting us with verification of the fact that not only do UFOs really exist, but that they're capable of interfering with our earthbound weapon systems. Both of those type of examples are not only food for thought, but are verification of some of the most important material imaginable, because in my opinion, it just goes to show that we are not alone in space, we are not alone in the universe, and there are other intelligences besides our own, meager as they may be. So, those are the immediate thoughts that come to my mind, and I'm very excited that this type of information is coming out. It should be interesting to see what kind of an effect it has on the wider segment of the population once there are more stories like this. And incidentally, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that this was actually released on a major news channel like CNN or something, so that anybody who checks into it will find out that it was not some fly-by-night newspaper like the Tatler or something like that. It was a well-respected news organization which released the information. Is that not so, Doug?
Well, yes. It was actually a press conference in front of the National Press Club. So, as I mentioned to you off the air when we had this conversation, I don't know if it was today or some other day, basically these invitations to the media seem to always center around people who are accepted within the mainstream on some level. I'm not saying that all of the people there were plants, let's say, to produce a certain literary after effect. In other words, the information that they were going to write up might not include everything heard in the video. But nevertheless, one wonders why more people aren't invited to participate in such events, especially those that have experience on some level of interaction. Doesn't have to necessarily be an abduction experience, but it could be one where there's communication going on. I've had that experience. I know others that have had that same experience, and what we know and what they're telling us are two different things. Now, this rings true. This information that we displayed for our listening audience holds the muster, so to speak. It matches. It fits hand in glove with some of my own personal experiences and my research, in a way, because when I was writing up the Eisenhower scandal about him not having a birth certificate, I discovered the UN link beginning on January 1st, 1942, which permitted the Lend-Lease program, which gave the Soviets everything they needed to participate in World War II. The American people paid for that. And you have to ask yourself, who is pulling what strings to bring such an abnormal relationship together with alleged enemies? And one of the Air Force bases involved in that Lend-Lease program, this is the funneling of military equipment and ammunition and cash and blueprints and nuclear secrets and even half of the U.S.'s stockpile of enriched uranium through Franklin Delano Roosevelt, through that Air Force base, Malmstrom Air Force Base, in Great Falls, Montana. So that is certainly a development that fits hand in glove with research and with facts that have been withheld from the public on a regular basis for 60 years, 70 years. You know, it's rather significant that comes out. So I wonder why, other than, you know, they want to curtail who gets their hands on the information. It's meted out according to what they're willing to admit. And there's a lot that's not being talked about, even with this information coming out. Your comments.
Well, I agree with you 100%, Don. I mean, this is just a perfect example of the fact that the public's being lied to, not only by the government, but also by all of the different military branches and heaven knows what else. And it's not just about UFOs and beings from other worlds that we've been lied about. That's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, everything imaginable is a lie. And that's all going to come tumbling down sooner or later. It just has to. No lie lasts forever. And I think that once the egg begins to crack, the crack is going to spread. And it's going to become more and more obvious that, you know, we have been victimized and lied to, not only by our government, but by other governments all over the world, the way they treat their own people. And this is nonsense that has to stop. But before it can be curtailed, it first has to be realized that this is a general trend, not just one isolated incident. This has been going on only God knows how long, and it covers every imaginable area of government, of science, of education, in politics, and, of course, in medicine. So it's just the beginning of what I hope is the unraveling of a very horrific beast that's been preying on humanity for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. And I know you didn't intend to exclude war as one of those elements, but, you know, this pretext that that we have to have war to bring about peace. It's like saying, well, you have to have disease so you can have health. You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
how
it's just about that. It's just about as twisted as that. Sure.
So, I know you have some specifics that you want to talk about, and I wanted to open up the show with a general comment. I've got a lot more testimonials, but we don't need to play them on the show here. People can go to YouTube and find those. Just look up the Disclosure Project. There's been quite a number of testimonials recorded on videotape with audio, where people can listen to several years worth of such information coming out. I can tell you this, Jim, and the listening audience, that this show is not just heard around the world. It's heard on over 2,000 different planets. And there are a lot of names out there of the groups that have been coming here, and many of the names are real, and many more are fictitious, and stories have been created around the fictitious beings or entities, visitors, aliens, ETs, whatever you want to call them. The government used to call them extraterrestrial biological entities, or EBs. And we've talked about that on shows a couple of years ago, 3 years ago even. My experiences there with JPL and the outright lies that they tell you. They don't believe in that. They never heard the term EB used, and you get a complimentary sky map and maybe some information about the SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and it comes from Washington, D.C., an office called EBE. You know, they rather trip over themselves in the fact that they can't get their lies straight and their cover story straight. But this show is heard on other planets because other planets are interested in what we talk about on this show. They're interested in the awakening that's occurring on planet Earth, and they are monitoring what's happening here because it has a direct impact on their civilizations, on their planets, and all the space in between as well. The insanity that is being demonstrated on this planet is reason for concern of anyone who intends to hang around for a while. So I turn the mic over to you, sir, and please feel free to ask questions or solicit comments at any time.
Well, that's, you know, it's a very long and interesting story, and there's two ways to look at it from my point of view. You know, one is to consider the objective information, such as what we just listen to tonight, coming from qualified individuals other than myself or you. And of course, we both know there are many of them around. The other situation, which I'm much more in command of course, is to reiterate some of the experiences that I've had, or perhaps that you've had, regarding this topic over the years, and how I got involved with it, and the interesting and very non-linear series of events that, you know, were actually initiated by those early type of investigations, and which led in so many different and unusual ways, you know, to the type of research that I've been involved with currently. My thoughts were that it might be worth visiting or revisiting some of that material, since I don't think we've discussed any of that now in a very long time, probably at least a year. What do you think of that possibility?
I'm with it. I have a question, but I don't want to jump the gun and spit out all the names. So I'll allow you to do that. I'm for that. And we have a lot of new listeners who've come to the show around the world who will probably be hearing this for the first time. So by all means, be my guest.
Well, the interesting thing is that this covers such an enormous period of time in my own life, you know, that sometimes it's hard to believe just how much time has gone by and how different a person I am today than I was, you know, when all this started. But the interesting thing is, the beginning of this involvement of my own with this subject probably goes back, you know, at least to high school, possibly earlier, and because I did have some childhood events which might be worth mentioning at some point. But the official story started when I was 19, and I was dating a very lovely girl in New Jersey, and we had been going together for about 1 year, and she decided to give me a little anniversary gift, and it was a book. And the name of the book was They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, and it was written by a guy named Gray Barker. And I was pretty thrilled because, you know, I thought it was a nice gift. It certainly was a reflection of the fact that she was aware of my interests. And so I dove into the book, you know, with a great deal of enthusiasm, and there was an awful lot of information in there, which was hard for me to believe at the time, talking about the men in black, talking about all these various experiences, people disappearing, murders, you know, proof that there have been events occurring in space and other ways on the planet which involve entities from space, you know, all that type of stuff. But the thing that was really mind-blowing, there was this one chapter in which they interviewed people who had some involvement in some of these early investigation attempts by citizens into the UFO mystery. There were a whole bunch of those in there. And this one guy who was interviewed actually had the audacity, and I thought it was kind of a very brave thing to do in those years, to give his name and his address, and made the comment that anybody that was interested in further investigating this subject and wanted firsthand comments or firsthand information from somebody who had already been looking into it, should feel free to contact this individual. And his name was Dominic Lucchesi. And turned out that he lived literally no more than 4 or 5 miles from my personal home at that time in Jersey City, New Jersey. And I was so excited that this guy was making himself available in a book, which was obviously published worldwide at that point in time, that I couldn't contain myself. I went and met this guy. We became very good friends. And through this gentleman, I was introduced to so many avenues of exploration and investigation that I can literally say that that book changed my entire life. Because before I got involved with all this material, my sole aim in life was to be a nuclear physicist and direct my energies towards the design of particle accelerators and experiments with high-energy particle physics. And by the time that I got done with following the clues and the connections and the trails that were introduced to me because of reading this book, I was relocated entirely in my design and my desire for my life's work. So I consider it a pretty pretty important and very pivotal point in my life. You do remember me talking to you about Dominic Lucchesi and some of the amazing things that that he was responsible for introducing me to, don't you, Don?
Yes, I do. You may want to just gloss over those for the listening audience.
Yeah, sure. The most important thing that came of it, quite honestly, well, first of all, the gentleman was well informed, and I mean very well informed. He had files in his personal collection that covered a whole series of avenues of investigation that he personally had spearheaded. And they included not only UFOs, but suppressed scientific information, discoveries in science and in medicine, which had not been allowed to germinate and be utilized for the betterment of mankind, knowledge of amazing knowledge of psychic phenomena, and people who had been involved in investigations on those fronts. And just it just went on and on and on. The thing that grasped my attention perhaps more than anything was this guy's enthusiasm for the work of Nikola Tesla, which I had already concluded several years earlier was of paramount importance. And it was through a discussion on Tesla and Tesla's proclamation that he had in fact discovered investigated the dynamic theory of gravity, that we came to the focal point of my relationship with Dominic Lucchesi. And he really blew my socks off on that particular day when he said to me, you're aware, of course, that that the information which Tesla talks about in his dynamic theory of gravity was supposedly bequeathed to another person after Tesla's demise. And I said, no, I have no knowledge of that. And he said, well, I guess that means you've never heard of Otis T. Carr. And of course, with that comment, he left the room and returned with a new file folder that contained a wealth of information about this character, Otis Carr, and the fact that he had attempted to go into business in 1957 in Baltimore, Maryland, with a company called OTC Enterprises, the sole object of which was to manufacture and distribute anti-gravity vehicles for for the use of the general public. And when I read all this, I was just blown away. I said, how is it possible that this guy could have actually had information of that sort and raised enough money to, you know, set up a plant where he was attempting to actually build these things and then just disappear off the face of the earth, which is, you know, basically what happened to the guy. And at that moment, I made myself a promise that I didn't care how long it took, I was going to find Otis T. Carr and talk to the man to find the real story behind this technology. Little did I realize at that moment that it would take another, oh my gosh, 15 years, something like that, for that dream to come true. But in the meantime, the most amazing thing that happened was we got talking about the technology associated with this craft that Otis Carr was supposedly building and the possibility that it had been initially designed by Nikola Tesla himself. And I asked him, you know, where did this information come from, and how was he aware of this guy's presence and his efforts to make use of this technology. And he put me in touch with a fella who was in Fort Lee, New Jersey at that time, a guy by the name of Jim Mosley. And Mosley was publishing a paper called The Caesarian News. And apparently, he had been at a conference just a few weeks earlier in which they had talked about the technology associated with flying saucers and this type of stuff. And there was a gentleman there who had made a speech or talk about using technology of an unusual nature to function as the propulsion mechanism in an electric car. And he was looking to raise money. And, you know, being totally gung-ho on this subject and knowing several wealthy families at the time, I didn't think that it would be a big deal, you know, to raise money for such a worthwhile cause, especially if it was true and that there was going to be a totally new type of technology behind the advent of this electric vehicle. So Fort Lee is another few miles away. I drove up to Fort Lee and met this fellow, Jim Mosley, and he looked in his files and gave me the name of this guy who happened to be living in Connecticut at the time, and his name was Gene Carini. And I contacted Carini and went to see him in Connecticut, and I was really amazed at some of the stuff that he showed me, because I had been involved in science all my life. My childhood activities were just flooded with scientific pursuits of all kinds, both in hobby and in study. And I thought I had pretty well had a handle on most of the stuff that was going on in the world when it came to that sort of thing. But on my very first visit with this gentleman, he showed me things that I had never seen in my whole life before. And not only that, but I never even suspected that they could exist. And that really was a very important turning point in my life. And at the time, I was between colleges and had been working to raise money to go back to school. And I was blown away by the fact that this guy offered me a job, you know, in his little organization as the director of research and development. I actually took that position and moved to Connecticut and worked there for the next 6 or 8 months. And I'm telling you the stuff that went on, and the things that I learned were just extraordinary. And,
now you mentioned, if I can interrupt for a second, Jim, you mentioned Otis Carr, being in Baltimore. And I know that at one point he moved his operation to Oklahoma City. And, where he eventually was successful, according to someone I met, Ralph Ring, who was one of the, we'll say, crew members that flew on the maiden voyage of this craft's first flight. He intimated that they went a very long distance in a matter of seconds, and when they had come back, they had all put dirt in their pockets. Of course, they didn't remember the experience. Now, that's the part of the story that I have a little bit of trouble with, because I don't think flying on a craft is going to cause you to lose consciousness. There seems to be a bit of a story being spun as to what actually happened there. But sometime after that, the government seized the craft and shut the whole operation down. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure, because the story is actually a little bit different than that. What actually happened in Oklahoma City, I got that firsthand from Gene Carini. Carini, it turns out, had been the electronics technician for Otis Carr during the developmental stages of the OXT-1 craft. I think also the OTC-X2, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, the craft that they had here in Oklahoma City was about 10 or 12 feet in diameter, from judging from the pictures. I didn't see it. And it was powered by neutrons and lag magnets, and they had built it in an aircraft hangar that was associated with one of the privately owned little airstrips somewhere around Oklahoma City. I actually located it at one point by the name. There's a big shopping mall there now, unfortunately. But anyway, what really happened at that point was that Carini had taken care of all the electronics in this craft. Otis Carr had supposedly designed it, but he had referenced to this this mysterious blue notebook, which everybody saw him sticking his nose in at various times during the construction of this thing. And they were having a problem with establishing how the craft should be grounded, not grounded to the earth, but grounded internally as far as an electrical system is concerned. And apparently there was an ambiguous there was certain ambiguity about how to do that for some reason, and that was the reason why Carini had the suspicion that the actual design was not Carr's himself, because if he had been the author of the concept, he certainly would have understood, you know, the procedure for supplying a common return line to the internal power system in his ship, and it turned out that he didn't. There was a fiber flange that was supposed to separate the upper and lower metallic portion of the ship and allow them to counter-rotate with respect to each other. And there was a series of brushes and large cables and stuff like that that were connected from the bottom section to the top section through slip rings on the center pole of the ship. And anyway, according to Gene, he never resolved the circuit problem to his own satisfaction. Carr insisted that they do it a certain way, and that's how they set it up. On the day that the test was supposed to happen, they had turned this whole airport into literally like an outdoor stage, and they had hundreds of people locally who were interested in seeing this whole phenomenon. And there was a guy that was invited all the way from New York, and I'm trying to remember his name. He used to have a talk show on at night. The name will come to me in a minute, but anyway, he and his camera crew drove all the way out here to film this happening. And what was supposed to occur was that the ship was supposed to levitate. They had it chained to the ground so that it could only go so high, and it was supposed to be a non-manned flight that was used as a proof of concept to then raise enough money to build a full-scale model of this thing, which they claimed would be able to fly to the moon and back. And what actually happened was that they started this ship up on its internal power, and the flanges began to rotate. According to Gene, he said that the thing got off the ground enough to put tension on those chains, and then all hell broke loose, and there was an internal short circuit. The thing came crashing down, and these neutrons, which were part of the internal power supply, which are shaped like two cones connected together, and they were held in gimbals at 45 degrees, and they rotated in this internal housing. Those units contained mercury, and the short circuit somehow sent current through one of these things inadvertently. The mercury boiled, the neutron exploded, there was mercury flung all over the place, and mercuric gas is released. Carr wound up in the hospital, and the whole place was in a panic, and people were running all over the place. And after that, two significant things happened. Carr moved his operation from there to
I think it was Apple Valley.
Town, but it was someplace in California. Valley.
Apple Valley,
California.
Yeah.
And Carini quit the team and returned to Connecticut to establish his own business. He also had a TV repair thing going on. So he went back to that, and that was the end of their association, at least on a continual basis. And it was in Apple Valley, California, where two things happened of interest. First of all, another guy came into the picture as the technological expert, and this guy, Ralph Ring, got involved. And when I met Ralph, he told me the story also, that the actual craft that they flew, you know, what was produced in the second facility in California, not the one in Oklahoma City.
Okay, yeah. I've heard conflicting stories, which is why I brought that up. But I do know that they did the operation there, and allegedly the successful flight was from Apple Valley. And they were kind of doing this out in the open. You would think with the type of scrutiny they would be about, there would be exercised on all levels, that they would at least try to do it someplace where they were in a shelter or something. Do you know if that craft was a symbiotic craft, or were they basically using principles of anti-gravity?
Well, from what I heard from Carini and from the drawings, which I actually have in my collection somewhere, the craft that Gene was involved with was an electromechanical device, and it was made of, you know, very husky but very primitive bulk type electromagnetic components. There was no solid state involved, no no real high-end technology that would be required to link the control of a craft to the minds of the occupants. That's just a lot of, I don't know if it's true or not, but I can't vouch for it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, I do know that the crafts that are flown from other worlds to here are symbiotic craft. They operate manually and they interface with whoever is piloting the craft and operate on a level of thought.
Well, that may be.
Yeah. Oh,
but I just think it was a little bit too far out for the 1950s and early 1960s, especially with the minuscule budget that was available to these individuals who are trying this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Building a 1,000-foot craft is extremely expensive. You know, you'd need another bailout to do that. And that's the kind of money you're talking in today's terms. Also, I would point out that the anti-gravity aspect of these craft serves the purpose only when the craft is near a planet and is escaping the gravitational pull, if you want to call it that. We have other ideas on what gravity is, but nevertheless, they use an antimatter drive system in space. That's how they go around. Once you're in space, the anti-gravity is useless. You know, until you enter the proximity of a planet and enter that planet's gravitational field. So just thought I'd make that distinction. That was stressed and underscored several times.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that. And that's an interesting point in itself, too, because the type of mechanism that I was initially exposed to was definitely made to operate only within the immediate vicinity of the planet Earth and also capable of shuttle-type activities between the Earth and the Moon, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish I could remember the name of that TV host that came out to Oklahoma City to interview Carr, because the interesting thing was that he had him on his TV show in New York quite a few times after that. And Carr was rapidly becoming a phenomenon, you know, back in that era. And it was amazing how much notoriety he had generated, especially with his TV appearances. And all of this was going on, you know, in full view of the public until the Apple Valley situation occurred. Now, whatever happened there was responsible for Carr going to jail. And he was put in, I don't know if it was a federal facility or what, but he was incarcerated for a time, because they accused him of, stock fraud, selling shares to build these spaceships, which supposedly would never fly, according to the government. And so,
Yeah, they're still doing that today, actually. You know.
Well, anyway, that's what ultimately happened to Carr. Now, I had a whole series of amazing episodes after my association with Carini, but jumping the gun a little bit, I will say that I eventually located Carr many years later, and he was in an old age facility in Keysport, Pennsylvania, and I did get to speak with him for about 12 hours, myself and another a very good friend of mine who only died here a couple of years ago. We flew out there and located him, after I had managed to find him. And we interviewed him for a long, long time, and he told us a lot of really interesting things. His particular focus was on the fact that he had really known he had really known Nikola Tesla. That was his claim. And that information had, in fact, been given to him by Tesla as to how to build a device that could float or levitate, whatever word you want to use, in the Earth's gravitational field. So it was a very interesting few years in finding this guy and what I went through in that time period. And you have to imagine the effect that this has on a person with at my age at that time and the enthusiasm that I had for the subject matter. It was really propelling, to say the least.
For our listening audience, my research on Nikola Tesla revealed that Otis Carr was the young man that delivered birdseed, particularly for the pet pigeons that Tesla had befriended from the neighborhood. They would hang out at his window ledge at the Hotel New Yorker and basically just wait for handouts. And he depended on somebody going out and getting the birdseed. And George Scherf enlisted Otis Carr. That's we could do 2-3 hour show on that. So I'm not going to open that can of worms, but there's a connection.
That's true because Carr told me himself, and so did Carini, that he had been working in that. I thought it was the Hotel Pennsylvania, but whatever the hotel was, he had been working there as a package clerk on the night shift. And he was sent out to get this bird seed or whatever it was for so many different times that his curiosity became aroused, and he went and visited when he delivered this stuff. He befriended Tesla and visited with him on several occasions, and that led to a kind of a father-son relationship, according to what Carr suggested.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's really fascinating about this whole thing is many years later, when I was working with Dennis Lee, I told Lee about this whole story and mentioned to him the fact that Carini was still living at that time, and if he really had some substantial information that could connect Otis Carr with Tesla, that it would be worthwhile for us to go and visit him. Now, he was living in Florida at that time, and so we did go down to see him, and of course, Dennis Lee immediately got into a conversation with him about so-called free energy, and that completely dominated the time that we spent there. So rather than listen to that, which I had heard a million times before by that time, I occupied myself trying to do something a little bit more constructive. Carini had a very amazing collection of tapes of interviews with all kinds of people that he had been interested in over the years. Some of them were so-called free energy developers, and like Lester Hindershot, for instance, and people like that. But he had a pretty large collection of tapes involving himself, Gene Carini, interviewing Otis Carr. And I started looking through this collection, and I found one tape that was labeled Carr Speaks on Tesla, or Carr Speaks About Tesla, something like that. So I started listening to that particular tape, and I had a notebook with me, and I took notes. And it got to the point where Carini was interviewing Carr and asked him if he had ever actually been in Tesla's suite. And he said, oh, yeah, many times. And he proceeded to describe the interior of Tesla's room. And he talked about all these bookcases with books, you know, on a myriad of subjects and models on top of all the bookcases and technical renderings displayed on the walls in the form of pictures and paintings and all this kind of stuff, and a big reference table and a huge mahogany desk over by the windows, and, you know, and he went on and describing all of these manuscripts and calculations laying all over the place. And then out of the clear blue sky, you know, I mean, if you're listening to this thing, it would shock you, because he's talking about stuff on the reference table. He's talking about all these books that are open to different pages and all this kind of stuff. And then out of the clear blue sky, he just says, but I never took anything. And I had to play that back at least four times. And I said to myself, my God, what kind of a statement is that to make? If you didn't take anything, why would you say that? And that's one of the things that led me to believe that the blue notebook that Carini had been talking about, having seen in Carr's possession many, many times, was in fact something that he had obtained from Tesla, but maybe it wasn't given to him. I mean, I don't know the details. But that remark that he made on that tape, I thought was totally extraordinary, that I didn't take anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's just not a normal statement.
Yeah, and the blue notebook came out later on, so that
yeah,
was that.
Yeah, I wound up seeing it myself and had the opportunity to look at it a few times. But what was really interesting was an admission from Carini at one point. When they were building the craft here, the OCTX-1 here in Oklahoma City, the thing that was interesting was, you know, Carr was a rum hound, and he used to drink pretty profusely. He had a nose just about the size of W.C. Fields's, and he oftentimes would be seen slipping off into the shadows, you know, to tip a little flask that he carried in his jacket pocket. But when they were nearing the end of the construction of that craft, the one that blew up, Gene came to discuss something with him one day about the brushes or the wiring or whatever. And he knocked a couple of times at the door, and nothing happened. So he opened the door to the office. And supposedly, Carr was there, sprawled across the desk in a drunken stupor. And Gene walked over there to try and physically rouse him. And when he got there, he realized that the blue notebook was sitting right there on the desk. And he couldn't resist the temptation of opening it, and he said that in the contents of that book, which was about, I'd say, 3/8 of an inch thick, it was a soft-covered book. It wasn't like a school tablet. It was more like those kind of books that they used to use in the 1920s in schools, where you wrote a composition or you wrote a report that filled up the whole book, mm-hmm. and turned it in. You know, it was a very different kind of a notebook. So the assumption was that it was from a different time period, and it was just filled with equations and sketches and drawings and designs for all types of different things. And when Carini was flipping through it, that's when he saw the layout for this, I don't know what you want to call it. Tesla, Carini used to call it the energized flywheel, but it was in fact a device which was based on Tesla's, instrument that he called the Earth-Moon experiment, and which he wrote about in the only article that I'm aware of where he published a great deal of mathematical support for the contents of the disclosure. It was published in two or three parts in one of the scientific journals of the time. I think it was called the rotation thoughts on the rotation or investigations on the rotation of the moon, something like that. And in there, he had drawn pictures of this device that he built that would allow him to duplicate the relativistic motions between the Earth and the moon. And it was so important to him that he published it. And, you know, that was so out of character. First of all, it was a mechanical device. And second of all, it was on a subject which he certainly didn't spend a whole lot of time on in his public ramblings. He usually was talking about electrical devices. So for Tesla to publish this, it was obviously something that he was pretty excited about. And then to see the same thing mirrored in this blue notebook, to the point where Perini copied various features of it and incorporated it into the propulsion system of his electric car, was a pretty extraordinary thing. And I got to study that material very carefully, not only when I was working for Perini, but in subsequent years. And I can tell you that there are some really extraordinary physical arrangements in the both the gearing and the way in which power is applied to these systems that were eventually influential in bringing me to the understanding that this was what Tesla was referring to when he talked about the fact that he had proved that power is relativistic. And it's just a very long, drawn-out story that connects a whole lot of things together. But it's very interesting that it all came from various people's interaction with this blue notebook. And, of course, as you pointed out, the blue notebook surfaced later on in the possession of somebody else, and the story continues on. It's a pretty amazing story, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, we're about out of time. Certainly, we could keep going on this topic. I know I sense your energy and your enthusiasm, and it's, even though we've talked about these things before, it's always interesting. It's like hearing it the first time again, because the information is so rare compared to all the disinformation that's out there, and what never ceases to amaze me is that we bring this information forward out of experience, out of truth, and revealing the truth to our listening audience, and they do everything they can to try to discredit the information. But, you see, none of what they're, when I say they, who am I speaking about? Well, those that run the space programs and those that are here on this planet from other realms and have been hiding and doing things in secret, which directly connects to all the secret societies and the secret ways that they have to meet and plot out their next plan for humanity and the destruction of the Earth. And it becomes old hat in a way. They become quite incompetent, because as the consciousness factor rises, they have to pour on what? Truth? No, they have to play the smoke and mirrors game and try to obfuscate not just the truth, but what they've been doing and what they do know about this and where they got that information, why that information became available to them. And you can't say that it's the advancement of science, because most scientists are ignorant of these topics, let alone the science, you know. So if you want to make some concluding remarks here, and we can certainly pick this up next week and continue on. There's a lot more to discuss.
Well, that's true. I'm happy to do that, too, because I like keeping all this information fresh in my own mind. And after all, it does represent a pretty amazing story. I just hope that it in the long run, it has a really interesting and worthwhile ending. But, the other thing that I want to do, since I really have a mental block against it right now, and it's unfortunate, I will look it up in my own records, the name of that TV host who actually brought all this to public television back in that day and age. And it'd be interesting to mention his name. But that would also give people something to check on because, you know, this was a well-documented and pretty unusual topic to get airtime back in the 50s and early 60s. And so when I remember this guy's name, I'm going to mention it the next time we talk about this. But the interesting thing is that if you look up Otis Carr on the Internet, there's actually a surprising amount of information about him there. And I know that one of the most detailed things that was ever written about him was actually published in, I think it was True Magazine, or one of those early semi-adventure type magazines that were floating around back then. I don't remember the name of the author, but I still have a copy of the original story. And it's a pretty revealing story. It's not written in a positive light, but then, of course, considering the net outcome of the whole Carr episode, there wasn't any positive light. So that's possible to understand. But it's very informative, and it gives an awful lot of details about some of the things that he tried to do. And one of the things that's really amazing, just to say this in closing, there were a lot of dead ends in the investigation of Carr's activities that were very suspicious. There were certain things where he claimed he had patents applied for on different aspects of his technology. They were never granted. That whole thing of information just disappeared. In an attempt to put that information in the public domain, he even made an amusement park ride of a flying saucer that supposedly revealed the mechanism by which it actually was intended to run or operate. And that very amusement park ride was built on a full-scale basis and installed in Frontier City right here in Oklahoma. And it was there for many, many years, and it showed all the internal workings, and it showed where the people would sit in the cab and everything, and that people were given rides on it in accompaniment with some kind of a movie that was shown of the ship leaving the Earth and that type of thing. And the interesting thing is I investigated that personally. There's absolutely no record of that device ever having been in the park, although there are pictures of it that are still floating around. And the interesting thing there is that the people who now own the park have no knowledge of it. There's no record of it. And one of the other dead ends that's worth mentioning is that the power pack itself, which supposedly was going to lift this craft, had actually been tested by an aircraft company of some notoriety. And since I don't remember the name, I'm not going to mention it. But it was one of the big ones. And that information disappeared. And then there were several people killed in aircraft accidents associated with the Otis Carr project. So it's very hard to to put it into a proper perspective as to whether the whole thing was a sham from beginning to end or whether it was a real honest intent at bringing forth a new technology, and it was very masterfully manipulated into a mysterious occupation of a drunkard individual who was eventually put in jail. I mean, it's just got so many facets to it that it's hard to categorize it.
Mm-hmm. A quick question here. Might that journalist, TV host have been Edward R. Murrow?
No. I know the name. It's on the tip of my tongue. But it's not that guy, no. It was
Ed Sullivan.
Another stuff.
We got a really big shoe.
It was not Ed Sullivan, no.
Just a little joke there, you know. Well, Jim, we got to wrap here, but I'm going to definitely continue this topic next week. So maybe by then you'll have remembered who it is.
I'll just go look it up. I got the files here. It's not that difficult, but I just have a mental block against it for some reason.
Okay. Well, maybe it's not supposed to come out tonight. That's the news for next week's show. Well, I want to thank you. It's been very interesting, and you know, it certainly connects the dots in a lot of ways. This goes much, much deeper than one man's venture to build a craft, because millions of people were seeing these all over the world long before any of this started, and they're still seeing them. And we're going to talk about that as well, I hope. So I want to wish you a good night and a fantastic weekend, and looking forward to seeing you next week, next Friday.
Thank you. I'll certainly be here. You take care, too.
All right. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and tonight's guest, Jim Murray. Special thanks also to Wind Talkers Radio Network over at BBSRadio.com. Want to thank Now at Station 2, Seth Hendrick on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me Monday night again here at BBSRadio.com, Station 2, for my special guest, Dr. A. Truat. I wish everyone a great weekend, and in the meantime, a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.